Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 209 of The Book Cougars, Two Middle-Aged Women on the Hunt for a Good Read. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chris. And we'd like to start off with a big thank you to Annette, who is our newest Patreon member. Thank you so much for your support, Annette.
We really appreciate it. And we also appreciate those of you who are renewing for another year. This time last year, Patreon allowed us to make a change where people can pay annually if they want. And we want you to know we see you if you're renewing. Thank you. And if you can't renew, no pressure. Right, I didn't mean that as a threat.
Yeah, yeah, because you could do the monthly thing, the annual thing, or nothing.
Right, exactly.
So we did a video over on YouTube/BookTube about our big summer challenge books. Sue Jackson does this every year, and longtime listeners know we participate in this reading challenge every year. It's so much fun. It's basically reading one or more 400-page books between Memorial Day and Labor Day.
Right. And you can try to find a book that's exactly 400 pages or 400 pages or more. And we shared our stack of hopefuls on that BookTube video. We will put a link in the show notes. We're not going to go over all of them today, but hopefully we'll be sharing them with you over the course of the summer as we read them.
Absolutely. And one of the things we had a question about in that video was one of our books is an international bestseller. And we wondered what an international bestseller is. Like, how do you qualify to become an international bestseller? And after a very short bit of research, I discovered on BookNet Canada that an international bestseller is when a book has appeared on two different official national best-selling lists. So like in the case of Canada, they mentioned the National Post. Here in the States, it would be like the New York Times. So an international bestseller has been a bestseller in two countries.
Yeah, that's really interesting to know. We were pondering it and we didn't have the answer. Now we know.
Now we know.
Thank you, Google.
And then in romance news, it was really interesting. Reading Publishers Weekly recently, they noted that astrology and tarot-themed romances are on the rise. So if you're into astrology, tarot, and want to try different romance subcategories, that might be one to explore.
Yeah, that's fun. Chris, what are you currently reading?
Well, I'm currently reading our second quarter read-along pick, The Awakening by Nora Roberts, which also happens to be a big book. I'm 55% in on this and really enjoying it. I'm listening to the audio primarily. I thought I would do the hybrid thing, but I'm enjoying the audio so much that that's what I'm doing. Gosh, I didn't write down the narrator's name, but she does a really nice job.
Yeah, I finished it and did it 100% audiobook because I thought the narrator was great. And also, most of the story takes place in Ireland and there are Gaelic pronunciations. And I just thought she did a great job with that and really brought the story to life that way.
Yeah, and it's just fun to hear the accent. She does a great Irish accent.
Yeah, fun. I'm reading I've Tried Being Nice, and these are essays by Anne Leary. This book pubs the day that this episode drops, which is June 4th. It's a book of 20 essays, and she has already written a memoir and four novels. So I've heard about her. I've wanted to read her. It's been on my radar. And finally, this is the book I've picked up. She's a great writer. She's very irreverent, really funny, but also poignant. And the first story is about being a people pleaser, which I can totally relate to, and how she's gotten to a certain age where she doesn't want to do that anymore. And I thought I would just read you one quick paragraph. This essay is called Batman. I was watching one of the morning news, which she has in quotations, shows recently, and as they cut away to a commercial, the female anchor said, "Coming up, the words no mother wants to hear from her child." This interested me because I had already heard the words no mother wants to hear from her child. These words are, "Mom, there's a bat on your pajamas." And then this essay goes on to talk about how they had a bat in the house and how extremely unsettling that was. Another one of her essays is about, she has talked about in her memoir, I know, and in other interviews I've seen her that she's a recovering alcoholic. And one of the essays talks about how she went on vacation with her kids and was served a drink that had alcohol in it. She was like, oh, I think I can do this now, because she had the drink and everything was fine. And then talks about how things didn't go well in her life after that. So she's really honest, I think, in these essays too, but using humor, which I really appreciate. So again, it's called I've Tried Being Nice, Essays by Ann Leary, and it's out now.
Well, I have a slew of books that I've started and put down for a variety of reasons. And so I plan to get back to a lot of them in the coming days. But one for sure is The Editor by Sarah Franklin, which I'm loving that so much. We talked about it last episode. Sarah Franklin was our guest on the last episode, episode 108. So if you haven't listened to that yet, do, because she gives fantastic interview and it's a great book.
Right on. I loved that book so much. I'm glad you're stepping back into it. Are you stepping? I don't know.
I'm cracking it open. I'm thinking about cracking it open like an egg.
I am reading This Is How It Always Is by Lori Frankel. This is my book for our in memorial reading.
In memory.
In memory.
In celebration.
Celebration. All of the above for our friend Jenny Colvin, who was the podcast host of Reading Envy. Longtime listeners will remember that we did some co-podcasts together with her. And we have started a conversation over on Goodreads, a thread called I'll Have What You're Reading, which was Jenny's tagline. This is the book I chose to read. It was on her TBR. Someone over on Goodreads, when I marked that I was currently reading it, Katz, she said, oh, I hope you love that book as much as I did. Katz, I'm enjoying it very much. It's a really sweet story about a family with five young boys, the youngest of which, Claude, wants to dress like a girl, and how that impacts the family. And I'm very, very just a little bit into it, but really enjoying her writing. It makes you laugh out loud and is poignant at the same time.
Nice. I like that you're reading humorous books.
Yes, me too.
So what have you just read?
I finished The Awakening by Nora Roberts, which I'm not going to talk about because we will be talking about it in depth on the next episode after we host our Zoom read-along discussion this coming weekend. I will say that I really liked it and intend to read the next book in the series, which currently is three. I think it just is a trilogy.
I think so.
Yeah.
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 Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know Tina said that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you?
I read The House That Horror Built by Christina Henry. This is a book that just came out. It just published May 14th, so it's hot off the press. I had received an advanced reader copy through NetGalley and Berkeley. Thank you both for that. I assumed it was a horror novel, and that probably colored my reading a little bit of it. It's technically classified as mystery and thriller, or sci-fi and fantasy, which I thought was interesting because it has paranormal elements in it. So thinking about it more as a mystery, it works a lot better than thinking about it as a horror novel. However, I have to say, I think this would be a really good read for people who are drawn to horror but don't like a lot of the grossness that can be in horror or the extreme terror that can be in horror. It's pretty low-key and manageable, what's going on. So the gist of the story is there's a woman named Harry who is a single mother. You get her backstory. She pretty much ran away from a very conservative, fundamentalist Christian family in Indiana and goes as a teen to Chicago and is homeless for a while. And then things happen and she has a child, right? And she's raising this child on her own. And it's just kind of towards the end of the biggest portion of the pandemic when things are starting to open up a little bit. She'd been working as a server, so everything was shut down during the pandemic, of course, and so she had no income. And she takes a job as a cleaner, as a household cleaner to this man living in a mansion in Chicago who happens to be like the hot, legendary horror filmmaker. And so one of the things she does is clean his props. He has all these props from old horror movies in his home. her son is a teenager who, and they both love horror movies. Harry and her son both love horror movies, so that's kind of a bonus, right? But she's very discreet and doesn't talk a lot about what she sees at the house. But things start happening, in particular with this one costume. And I'll just leave it at that. It is set in Chicago, as I've mentioned. There was one, there's not a lot of Chicago action, but there were a couple things that just made me smile, like the son talking about going to Ann Sather's and having their cinnamon rolls. Like, that's a restaurant in Chicago that's famous for their cinnamon rolls. I mentioned on Goodreads that it was my bedtime book. So at one point I was a little bored with it, which probably worked in my favor because I didn't, you know, lose too much sleep over it. It did kind of wrap up toward the end and it had a fairly satisfying ending. Again, I would recommend it to people who might like light horror with some mystery elements.
Yeah, no one's like being beheaded and things like that.
I don't think so. I mean, I have to be really, I mean, take what I say with a grain of salt, everyone, because like my wife, Laura, does not like violence and grossness in books. And she had wanted to try a mystery one time. And I was like, well, try this one. This one doesn't have anything gross in it, you know? And I got home from work that day and she's like, okay. She's like, on the third page, there's a severed foot in the refrigerator. I was like, really? I was like, I have no memory of that. So there is that to consider. Right. But I did enjoy it, and I felt like some of the elements could have been developed a little bit more. But again, this was an advanced reader copy that I read. Interesting story, and I look forward to reading more by Christina Henry. One of her previous books was called The Horseman, I think, which is set in Sleepy Hollow, about the legend of...
The Headless Horseman.
The Headless Horseman. And Ichabod Crane and all of that. Yeah. So again, that was The House That Horror Built by Christina Henry. It's available now.
Now I want a cinnamon roll. Thanks for that. I finished Pay Dirt by Sarah Paretsky. Sarah Paretsky is our author spotlight on this episode. So we talk quite a bit about the story and why she wrote it. It's the 22nd book in the V.I. Warshawski series. She is a private detective, typically in Chicago, but four of the novels take place in Kansas, and this is one of them. All of the novel really takes place there. I think she goes home to Chicago to gather things one time, but other than that, she's there the whole time. And it's a really interesting book where Sarah brings in some issues that are common today in society. And I think she does a really good job. It's very thought-provoking. So if you're looking for a 50-something-year-old private detective, this would be a good series to get yourself into. I know, Chris, you've read some other ones,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the earlier ones, yeah. And she's an author I always intend to read more of whenever I come across her, because I did enjoy some of those earlier ones because they're set, like, you know, in the South Side or the Loop in Chicago. So it's kind of, it's always fun to read a book set where you know, written by somebody who is intimate with the location and not just using it as a backdrop necessarily, you know?
Right. And she lives in Chicago and has for a long time, but she grew up in Kansas. And so that's why some of her novels are set there.
Right. Yeah. Family connection there. Yeah. She was one of the first mystery novelists that I started reading when I started reading mysteries. And I liked her because I liked when the detective got a little worked over, you know, like that she's a hard ass. She can roll when bad things happen.
And even though she's in her mid-50s, she's still doing it in Pay Dirt.
Yes.
Which is something that Sarah actually talks about in the interview. So give that a listen at the end of the episode. And it's out now. And we have a giveaway.
Yes. We were fortunate enough to receive from the publisher copies of the finished book, as well as three of her backlist titles.
Deadland, Overboard, and Shell Game.
Yes. So we received those to use as a giveaway. So one lucky newsletter subscriber will win all four of those books. If you're not a newsletter subscriber, it's super easy to subscribe. Go to our website and there is a subscribe button there, a link that you can click. We only send one email a month, so we promise not to spam you with annoying things.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast yesterday and they were talking about how people have subscriber fatigue.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah.
It is a real thing. I mean, in some companies, I just unsubscribed from one that I really wanted to support this company because it's, you know, LGBTQ, woman-owned kind of thing. But they were sending like multiple emails a week.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
That's just too much.
Yeah, we all have email fatigue, but we don't do that. We send one email at the very end of the month. So we would love for you to subscribe. And if you do, you're automatically entered to win giveaways. We will be giving these books away on June 15th. So you have plenty of time to subscribe.
Yes. So that's for this episode. And then every 10th episode, we also do a giveaway. So episode 210 will be another 10th episode. So you have two giveaways kind of back to back coming up.
So get your fingers limber and sign up.
So here we now are entering the short story segment.
I've been reading a short story every Monday.
You've been doing a great job with that.
I've been really enjoying it.
Nice. We also read some short stories. One in particular we decided to read together in honor of Alice Munro, who passed away recently.
Yeah, and she was very well known for short stories. I thought she was also a novelist, but I was corrected recently that she only wrote short stories, correct?
Right, yeah.
And so we decided we would do a joint read of one of her short stories, and we decided to read Train.
Yes.
And this was originally published in Harper's Magazine, and I actually just went online and read it directly there. So I'll put that link to the show notes so you can get to it for free. I also have it in the Best American Short Stories 2013. It was in that.
Okay.
Where did you read it?
Well, I checked out from work this collection, Family Furnishings, Selected Stories, 1995 to 2014. By Alice Munro, and she's also the winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. But I also ended up reading it online using that Harper's link because I was reading it in bed, and that's on my iPad, so that's super convenient.
I think it was also in her collection called Dear Life. I'm pretty sure.
Probably, that's right? Because yeah. This is a collection thing. So
yeah. What did you think?
Well, I realized that I always have a little bit of resistance when I start a short story. Because I want to read a novel, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something about starting a short story that makes me a little antsy and resentful. But I quickly got sucked into this one because I didn't really know what time period we were in. It starts off with this man on a train coming home from the war. He throws his bag onto the tracks and jumps off, going in the opposite direction from where the train was going. And I started wondering, what's his deal?
Mm-hmm.
And then quickly enter a cow and a woman. And I enjoyed it. You know, it went by really fast because I think it was like, 30 pages or so?
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised that this was in a magazine.
Yeah. It was over like 10,000 words, I think. So that's a pretty sizable short story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was almost like what I consider New Yorker size short stories. Yeah. Sometimes those are really long too.
What was your experience like in the very beginning, the first couple pages?
Well, I have read it before, so this is a reread for me. In general, short stories are really working for me right now because I'm reading a lot of grants. I'm in the middle of a grant cycle. So I enjoy the short story because I know it's not as much of a commitment and I don't have to get too invested in my brain. You know, like I know it's going to start and finish.
Yeah.
And I can put it down.
That's so good. That's so smart.
I had a lot of resistance when I first started reading short stories because I felt I'm just getting interested and it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's almost like a relief. I really want to read, but I don't want to have to remember what I'm reading tomorrow.
Right. Or have the guilt of like me in my situation, like starting too many books and then not finishing any of them. And
interesting. Or for me, it's also the guilt of I keep buying short story collections and not reading them. So this project that I'm doing is really scratching that itch. But anyway, so to get back to the story, as soon as I started reading it, I was like, well, I don't remember it from last time. So here I am, fresh start. And I found her writing really interesting because she doesn't really offer any backstory. You know, you're just in it. The people are there. They're talking to each other. They seem very accepting of like, oh, a stranger just came to my property and I'm going to welcome him. And he's going to become part of my life. And I just thought that was really interesting and also made me question how I would feel if that was my life. It was a different time, but
yeah, so I thought that was interesting. You know, that post-war, mm-hmm. and she's all alone, mm-hmm. right? And the house is practically falling down around her.
Mm-hmm. But even then, you'd think even more she might be, like, suspect. I think we should encourage people to go out and read Alice Munro because she really is an artist when it comes to short story writing. And I personally think she's quite dark, at least from the collection that I read. And this has darkness, this story. But a lot of it's unsaid, which is so interesting. And that's why I think she's an artist. Well, of course she's an artist, but you know what I mean? Like the art of using few words to paint a picture.
Right. And then later, things happen that I didn't anticipate happening, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And what I expected to happen did not happen. And then there's some revelations about both of the characters later on that mm-hmm. helps you see why they were like they were.
Right.
But I still can't believe some of the choices he made.
Mm-hmm. So there's no backstory, but then she fills it in at the end. Is that the way to say it?
Yeah, yeah. But it's not like a necessarily an info dump, you know what I mean, in that way. Because like Emily said, she is an artist and her writing feels as open as the plains, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like you just feel like, I don't know, I just imagined, and this is in Canada, but I just imagine like the house and the railroad and their Mennonites in the area. So like it's country-ish. And I just had such a picture in my mind about mm-hmm. the story. Not that the characters are simple, but they're portrayed without baggage, I guess, mm-hmm. right? I mean, not even their clothing is baggage.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
There's so few descriptors. I mean, mm-hmm. it'd be interesting to reread it when it's fresh in your mind to see, like, how does she create images with so few brushstrokes, to use a painting analogy?
Well, that's interesting you should say that, because one of the notes I wrote down was that she really uses white space. She'll have a paragraph and then white space and then one sentence and then white space and then a paragraph or dialogue or something like that. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting mm-hmm. that she does that.
Yeah, because this story, what, it's like 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. if not more. It starts post-war, so it starts in the 40s and it's up until at least the late 60s, I think.
Yep.
Did it motivate you to want to read more Alice Munro?
I think so. I mean, my book group read a collection and then we tried to talk about it as a group. And it's kind of hard to talk about short stories, is what we discovered, like what Chris and I just did. You don't want to give spoilers. I mean, in book group, you can give spoilers. But here, we don't want to give spoilers. Short stories can be really short or really long, but they're hard to talk about, I feel like, sometimes. Like we've talked about when we drove to Edith Wharton's house, The Mount, we had read some of her short stories and we talked about them for a 2-hour drive.
Right.
And we read two little short stories. And then we were kind of like, oh, I need to read it again because maybe I misunderstood what she was doing with that, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's amazing to me because you can do that with a 15-page short story or a 1,500-page book.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for example, I read, moving on into my short story project, I read two stories. I broke my rules. I read two stories from this collection called The Goodbye Process by Mary Jones. And this book publishes on July 30th. Thank you to Zibby Books for sending us this advanced reader copy. The first two stories are super duper short. The first one is 2 pages. It's called From Outside I Could See, and it's about a woman who's sitting on the doorstep of her house as her husband boards it up, and it's just so disturbing and amazing, and it's 2 pages, which is why I had to go immediately read the second story, which was called The Next Husband Game. This one is 4 pages, and it's about a married couple who play this game that they think is really good for their relationship, where it's like, well, my next husband will remember to close the dishwasher door after he loads it. And then the husband will say, well, my next wife will, you know, well, I'm not going to say what he actually says, because that would be inappropriate. will say, well, my next wife will cook dinner every night for me. And so they play this game, not recognizing that it's actually deteriorating their relationship.
Yeah. Sarcasm is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not
sarcasm helping. And passive aggression.
Yeah.
So, oh my God, I am definitely going to continue with this short story collection. Plus, it has the most beautiful cover. It's one of those Italian Bialetta espresso pots, stovetop espresso pots, with two little espresso cups and smoke coming off of one of them.
So Mary Jones, is this her first collection?
This is her debut short story collection. Hmm. Yeah, so good. And it's blurbed by Jill McCorkle, whose book Old Crimes is one that I've read short stories out of a couple times. And she says, Mary Jones' delightful story collection, The Goodbye Process, is full of surprises, sometimes funny, often heartbreaking, always memorable. And I would agree with that, because those 7 pages I read were so memorable to me. And then the other collection that I read a story from is called The Ill-Fitting Skin by Shannon Robinson. And she won the 2024 Press 53 Award for Short Fiction. This just came out in May. And I read the story called Origin Story. And it's about a mom. And it starts, the very first sentence is, never bite back. That's what all the parenting websites tell you. So, you know, when your kid goes through the phase where they're biting, which is so difficult, especially if they're biting other children. So you think it's just going to be this simple little story, and then it turns out that their child is a werewolf. Really good writing. Wow. So 2 really amazing short story collections.
All right. Well, I also read another short story, one by Willa Cather. Ardessa is the name of it. It was published in 1918. And, you know, come to think of it, Cather isn't nowadays known necessarily as a short story writer. People usually think about her novels more than her short stories. So reading her stories has been really interesting. And this one is about a middle-aged woman of the old school of doing business who initially helps her boss, who buys this magazine. He's wealthy from out west. She helps him understand the social aspects of who all of these writers are and people, like who she needs to pay attention to, who can wait, who could not be seen, all that kind of stuff. So she comes from this old school where it's more about the relationships between people, and the business world is changing to be more about efficiencies. And she looks down on the girls, in quotation marks, who are doing the work. She thinks they're crude. I don't want to give any spoilers with this story. I read it twice. And the first time I read it, I thought, well, that was a good, interesting story. There are a couple of things that stood out. The fact that Becky is the name. She's one of the young women who's really wanting to learn as much as she can. And Ardessa is happy to push work off on her that she herself should be doing. This backfires on her. But Becky is Jewish. She's equated to pretty much being, I think, a black servant or a slave, even the way she's treated in some of the, she's called a savage, a young savage. And that was even in the caption of the story as it was published in the magazine back in 1918. But in the context of the story, she's actually referred to as a Kaffir girl, which is ethnic slur. And there's this whole conversation about her asking if she could wear white shoes to work. So, I mean, it's kind of a complex story in some ways. Maybe it's not complex. Maybe it's blatant. And I just think it's complex. But, you know, the way she does this and the way she's making Becky not have access to whiteness, it's really a story that shows how the old school tries to keep white supremacy in place by comparing itself against all these other cultures. So it's interesting. And it's clunky in some ways because she mentioned so many different traditions, you know.
It's interesting because both of us are talking about rereading stories. Being someone who's like, I don't reread, I really don't reread novels at all. I have several times as I've been doing this short story project, reread the short stories as soon as I've finished them. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show kind of how hard it is sometimes to discern what they're trying to say in such a short piece. And so easy to go back and reread it because it is short.
Right, yeah. And you think, did I think what I thought was what they were writing,
right?
Or did I make that up? And so rereading it doesn't take much effort at all. It was interesting to go back and look at it more in terms of the racial stereotypes and then also the misogyny, because the men don't do much work in the story. It's the women doing all the work, specifically the Jewish women and the black women. They don't even manage. It's a particular woman in the office who's pretty much doing the personnel management type stuff. So I like the story. You know, one of the things I'm realizing through doing this challenge is how Cather's style had evolved. And I was thinking about her later stories where, in her novels, where, you know, she believed like less is more. Like there's too much in stories. And so stripping it away and having it almost be as bare as a Greek stage is the way to go. And this story was published kind of late in her short story career, early in her novelistic career. So I'm fascinated now to start reading what's come after this story, because critics have also said she wrote this for money. And I can see that now and not get defensive and be like, yeah, she did. She needed to pay the rent. Right.
And people do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Artists included.
Yeah. So anyway, that was Ardessa by Willa Cather.
Right on.
So what biblio adventures have you been on, Emily?
I went to a couple really great biblio adventures by myself, and then one that was a joint jaunt that we'll talk about also. So I went to RJ Julia Booksellers just down the street in Madison, Connecticut, to see Tom Straw in conversation with our mystery man, John Valeri, about Tom's new novel called The Accidental Joe, The Top Secret Life of a Celebrity Chef. John did a great job asking questions. It was a really fun conversation, and it also helped that Tom Straw is very funny and has had a lot of experience as a television writer. He's just really entertaining. So The Accidental Joe was inspired by Tom's love of Anthony Bourdain, and also he and his wife travel a lot, and when they travel, they like to eat, which I can totally relate to. And they also even do cooking classes when they go abroad. So one day he was running and he had this thought, what if Anthony Bourdain had actually been a CIA agent? Because what a perfect cover. He traveled all over, quote, looking at food, you know, and cooking and things like that. So that was the little seed that was planted one day when he was running. But then, of course, he had to write a novel about it. He talked about how the first draft was actually in third person omniscient, and it was just blah. It wasn't going anywhere. So he rewrote the entire thing in first person and then added that like breaking the wall thing where the narrator talks directly to the reader. So that sounds really fun. I have not started reading it, but I want to. I intend to. And he also announced that night that the second book in the series, Hangry Globe, he had just finished. Oh, one of the other things, Chris, that I thought you might like is he was talking about how lovely the mystery community is, you know, mystery writers. And he said he and his friends hide little things in their books that are like meta inside jokes for each other, whether it be how they name characters or a place they go or something like that. And I thought that was fun. Yeah. So it was a really fun event. You were missed. Oh, one other thing I did want to say is this is published by Regalo Press. I think that's how you pronounce it. And they have a charitable arm. So they allow the authors to choose a charity that they want some of the proceeds, a percentage of the proceeds to go to. And because of what this book is about, Tom Straw chose World Central Kitchen.
Nice.
Which is such a great organization.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds really good. And that whole thing about putting little things in the book for your friends, it's like, then you'll know if they read the book.
Right. That's true. That's really true. I didn't think that would have been a fun question. Like, have you ever realized, like, my friend told me they read it, and then I said,
she never said anything about the blah, blah, blah.
Right, exactly. And John Valeri wrote a really nice review of this book over on Criminal Element. So I'll put a link to that review in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I was bummed to miss that, and I was working.
Yeah, sometimes we got to do that thing called work.
Yeah. Well, our joint jaunt was a lot of fun. This was on a night that I didn't have to work. So we went to see Sandra Yanone's poetry reading at the Acton Public Library in Old Saybrook. It was such a great reading.
It was lovely because what she did was invited three friends to join her. She would do some of the reading, and then she'd introduce her friend, and then the friend would stand up and say how she knew Sandy and why they chose the poems they wanted to read, and they would read the poems.
Yeah.
It really mixed it up.
It really did. I've never been to a poetry reading like that before, and how lovely it was. I've known Sandy for a long time. Back in the day when I was at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, she started a poetry reading series there that met on Fridays. I should have remembered what a good reader she was, you
right.
know. And when I said to her afterwards, like, God, that was a really great reading. I love the flow of it. She's like, yeah, well, I've been doing this for a while, Chris, right. you know.
I have a little experience.
yeah. And she was a director of a writing center at a university out west, too. So she has a lot of experience with education and yeah. I think presenting.
And it was really beautiful because her father owned a stained glass studio, which is what a lot of the poetry is about. And she brought some of the stained glass lamps and they were reading underneath this beautiful floor lamp yeah. that had a beautiful stained glass, you know, shade on it. It was really lovely.
Yeah. So her new collection is called The Glass Studio. And if you look at the cover, it's actually a photograph of one of her dad's pieces, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's beautiful. So, really wonderful event. I love her poetry. Highly recommend both of her books. And we'll put links in the show notes. And I should also say, too, like, Sandy's from Old Saybrook originally and is living in Old Saybrook again. So, it was a bit of a homecoming for her to have the event at her childhood library.
Yeah, really lovely. I also went to an event in Westerly, Rhode Island, at the Westerly Library, and this was in partnership with Bank Square Books in Mystic. I didn't realize it when I signed up for it that the name of the event was called On Writing, a panel discussion with authors on their craft. So it was really speaking to people about writing. So the room was filled with a bunch of writers, which was really cool. And the authors that were there were Laura Ehrlich with her set of short stories called Animal Wife, Anne Hood with her novel, The Stolen Child, which is a historical novel that just came out. Vanessa Lilly was there with her novel, Blood Sisters. We've both read that novel and we met her when we were at the Lou Anne Rice event.
Yeah, really enjoyed that one.
And Deborah Goodrich Royce with her novel, Reef Road, which I really enjoyed. And Deborah kind of was the moderator for the event. She did a great job of asking a question, kind of answering it from her perspective, and then passing the mic on to the other authors. I could talk about this event all day. I won't do that because we have, you know, a timeline here. But it was really, really good. And I'm not a writer. I just thought they did such a good job of...
I just wanted to stop you about saying you're not a writer.
I try to write.
You are a writer, Emily Fine.
Okay. Thank you. It was really, really good. I got a lot of hints about little tricks of the trade, I guess is the best way to say it. I was trying to take notes, but also pay attention. So I wrote down some things that made absolutely no sense when I went back to look at my notes. I went with our mutual friend, Emily, who is an editor of a magazine. I mean, she writes full-time for a living. This one made both of our jaws drop. And it sounds so simple, but I think it would be useful for so many people. Anne Hood said that one of the best pieces of advice she's ever received was from author Alice Hoffman. And she said, when you're on that version of your book, like you're on the 10th draft, and you just feel like, I cannot possibly look at this book one more time, change the font.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So simple. I mean, it's a simple change on your computer.
Yeah.
You also could print it, you know, in a different font, and it just makes you look at your writing in a different way.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm working on grant analyses right now where I have to do a lot of writing, and I will often take a piece of writing and put it in a different document to look at it that way. But I've never thought, oh, also change the font and then maybe it'll spark a little something in your mind.
Interesting. Yeah.
So that was a fun takeaway. And then someone else, they were talking about being genre writers. And one of the authors said, genre is about setting readers' expectations. And she likes to write to subvert those expectations. And I thought that was a fun way to say that. Anne Hood, she was the older one of the group, and she talked a lot about fun little stories. And one of the things she talked about was being a very young writer. And she was an international flight attendant at the time. But when she was home in New York, she was auditing a class at NYU that was a writing class. And she didn't pay to be there, but her writing got attention. And the professor called her to come to his house. And her boyfriend at the time was like, I don't think that's a very good idea, you know? And she was like, well, I'm just going to go and see. And her boyfriend said, well, I'm going to stand outside the window. And this is like some tall apartment building in New York City. But, you know, if you need help, like, I don't know, open the window and wave. I don't know what the plan was. But she said she got there and his wife answered the door. And right away, she felt very comfortable. And he brought her back to his office and said, I really want you to focus on your writing. You're a writer. You've got what it takes. There's a spot left in the Breadloaf residency and I want you to go. And that is like the residency that writers try to get. She said, I had no idea what he was talking about. And he was like, it's a 2-week residency. And she said, well, I can't do that. I spend all my time on flights saying, do you want chicken or beef? You know? And he was like, really, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. So she said, I called work and said, I have the flu. I'm going to have it for 2 weeks. And she went. And that's where she met people like John Irving, who was making pizza in the kitchen and throwing out advice to her. And it completely changed her life.
That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Cather taught at Breadloaf 1 year and Sandy Yanone went to Breadloaf as a writer.
Wow.
Yeah. So Breadloaf is the theme.
Yes. That's really interesting. Oh, and then one of the final takeaways was the author saying it's really important to find your people, whether you go to a residency like that, which they all admitted was hard to do, or go to a conference, which can be expensive, or even if you just have a writing group that you write with or one friend that you write with. And Vanessa Lilly piped in and said, yeah, like basically your family doesn't want to hear endlessly about the characters in your book. You have to find somebody else who will help you. So that was really funny. And Lily also recommended The War of Art, Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles by Stephen Pressfield.
Yeah, I read that one.
Did you? Do you agree?
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I read it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I appreciate all the battle imagery and the antagonisms with art and stuff like that. But I think depending on where you are and how you're looking at it, and I know it's been a very popular book for a lot of writers.
She said it's very short. It's under 200 pages. And what she was saying is like when she hits a roadblock, she's all about craft and go get a book, go get something that will help you. And she said she could recommend probably at least 50 of them, but that's the one she recommended.
Yeah, it'll get your butt in gear, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then the last thing that Vanessa Lilly said that I wrote down was that she attended an RWA, Romance Writers of America conference, where Nora Roberts spoke. And she said her takeaway was that they take their craft very seriously. So I thought that was interesting she threw in a little thing about the romance genre. So it was a great event. I really enjoyed it. And then the only other thing we did while we were there is we went down the street to Savoy Bookshop closed, which made us so sad. But it has reopened as Martin's Books.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And someone told me he was an employee of Savoy. I didn't meet Martin. Though it looked really the same, except that they spread out the cafe tables. So there's more places to sit and drink your coffee and read. And it seemed to me like the menu had expanded and they had food and other things. We hadn't been at Savoy for a while, so maybe they had done that before they closed. I don't know. But it was really lovely and it was filled with people, which was nice to see.
Yeah.
So it was a great day in Westerly. You were missed.
Well, I was with my writer's group that day.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
It all worked out.
It did.
Weird. So do you have any upcoming jobs?
I do. I have a work meeting on Friday in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And if it gets out early enough, I plan to walk over to Kindred Thoughts bookstore, which is a African-American-owned, part woman-owned, part veteran-owned bookstore there in Bridgeport. So fingers crossed on that, because I think they close at 6 p.m. on Fridays.
So you have to make sure your work event doesn't go too long. Well, I have one that I'm hoping to do at home, a couch biblio adventure. There's a new 8-part TV series. It's an adaptation of Scott Turow's Presumed Innocent that's dropping on Apple TV in early June, or maybe mid, I think it's mid-June. So I read Presumed Innocent and really liked it. It was published in 1987. There's a movie also that came out in 1990 starring a very young Harrison Ford and Bonnie Bedelia. And I want to watch that movie and then watch the TV adaptation. So I'm going to do a little Presumed Innocent-a-thon.
Very cool.
Really excited. And then I'm also hoping, fingers crossed, I don't know if this will work because of my work deadline, but Sarah Franklin, the author of The Editor, is going to be in conversation with Kathy Gunst Tuesday, June 4th, the day this episode drops, at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge at 7 p.m. Reminder that Sarah was our guest on episode 208. The Editor is out now. And Kathy Gunst is someone who I took a food writing class with, talking about writing, who I never met because it was during the pandemic. So I did that online. I would love to meet both of them. So I'm hopeful.
Oh, good. Fingers crossed you can make that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then the next night, June 5th, you and I are going to see Percival Everett in Hartford.
That's right.
Yes. We have tickets for that. They were going to have it at the Mark Twain House, but then there were so many tickets immediately snapped up, they are moving it to a larger location.
Yes.
So there's that. And then the other event I plan to do is the Willa Cather Spring Conference, June 6th to the 8th. It's in person out in Red Cloud, Nebraska, but for years now they've had an online element via the Whova app, which is really good. I enjoy that. So for the last couple of years, I've been saying, next year I'll go in person, because I haven't been to the spring conference in decades. And every year something comes up, right? Or, you know, there's a conflict of some kind. So my new philosophy is to say, I'm not going to the spring conference next year. Maybe I'll never go again. And then hopefully I'll trick the universe into making it happen.
I guess that's not reverse psychology, but it's similar.
Well, I'm reverse psychology on the universe.
Yes, on your on the manifestation. So you went, since I've known you, you've gone once, but was it not for that conference? It was for something else?
Yeah, so every year they have the spring conference, which is in Red Cloud. But then every second year, they have an international conference. And that was the one I went to when it was in Virginia.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm thinking of. Okay.
They have those in different locations that have been significant to Cather's work in some way. You know, last time it was in New York City. I think a future one's going to be maybe in Milwaukee. I'm not sure. And they've done international. They were in Ireland. They've done France. So
Cather got around.
She sure did. So traditionally, and I think this might be changing a little bit, I'm not 100%, but the spring conference is traditionally more for like scholars and readers. It's more relaxed and not as heavily academic, although there is that. And then the international conference is more academic in a lot of ways. And then they also have a journal that's put out based on some of the essays that are presented or some of the papers that are presented at that conference. So,
Okay. I knew you'd gone somewhere. So, Chris, do you have any upcoming reads?
Oh, gosh, I do. I'm so excited to dig into a couple of these books. Let me see. Let me get my stack over here. Oh, lift, lift. Since I checked out this book from the library, The Woman's Room by Marilyn French. It's a library copy, so I need to get on it. I plan on starting this one as soon as I finish The Awakening.
And that is one of your big book summer reads.
It is, indeed. Yes, I had a fun time talking about that on that video that we did. And then another book, I checked it out of the library, but I'm not 100% if I'm going to read it. I'm certainly going to flip through it. This is one where it's like, oh, good, he did it, so I don't have to. It's by Alec Wilkinson, and the title is A Divine Language, Learning Algebra, Geometry, and Calculus at the Edge of Old Age.
Oh, no, thank you.
I have had thoughts about doing that. Like, when I, quote, retire, like, trying to learn math, because I suck at math. I really do. I mean, I passed algebra by cheating. Like, I was a senior, and I cheated off the freshman or something like that. I don't know. I just, my brain just doesn't go that way, I guess. But I thought it would be fun to do when I have more time. But he wrote this book about his experience with it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and I don't know. I'm not aware of him. I haven't read anything by him. But he's had a good chunk of books published.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to push back, just like you did on me about being a writer, that you do math every day. It's just you do the math that you need in your life. And also, being a student of history, you understand math in calendar format in a way that I don't. So you and the gentleman caller are very similar. Like, whenever you're talking about a book, you place it in time. That's math.
That's interesting.
I can't do that math at all.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, Emily. That gives me a different perspective.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I made a fool of myself talking to him about something the other day, and he was like, yeah, that took place 40 years difference, you know, and I was putting them together because it was like a similar thing that happened.
Yeah.
So it's really important to understand history, or I shouldn't say it's really important. It's a different kind of math that you're doing to understand that.
Well, it's so interesting to me, like some of the things like geometry, spatially, I'm really good. Like I have that engineer mind about space, which is...
Which I don't have at all.
Yeah, but the math, yeah, it's interesting. Weird. I love that meme that was going around a while ago that, you know, it's a picture of a smartphone with a calculator app open, and the headline says something like, my teacher said, you need to learn how to do division and multiplication because it's not like you're going to have a calculator in your pocket all the time. And it's like, well, sorry, Mrs. Teacher, I do now.
And that changed from our generation to, like, I know my kids' generation, because they were then allowed to bring calculators to the SAT and stuff.
Yeah.
And we were not allowed to do that.
I didn't do the SATs, but like in tests at school, you could not have a calculator with you. And now it's like, you know,
can have fancy ass calculators.
Those graphing calculators are amazing. I know how to turn them on and off.
Right.
That's about it.
My kids both had them, and I was happy to keep them in batteries, but I never taught them how to use them because I didn't know how. Well, I too have one of my big book summer reads that we talked about on the video called A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. This is the first book in the All Souls series. And people in the comments got very excited that I was reading this book. So it made me want to read it even more. And one person also piped in and said that book 5 in this series is dropping this summer. And so I looked it up, and it is on July 16th, and it's called The Black Oracle. Mm. So there are 4 books already in the series, a 5th one coming out.
You know, she was at Book Expo 1 year when we went. She's one of the authors I stood in line to get autographed.
I remember that now. Mm. I didn't put that together. Interesting. You were very excited.
Mm, totally.
And it was a long line.
It now was. It was one of the longest ones.
Yeah. And then I also have, also from the library, I went to the library as well, The Mystery Guest, a maid novel by Nita Prose. This is the 2nd book in the series. The first one was called The Maid. And in this one, an acclaimed novelist has died at the Regency Grand Hotel. And Molly Gray, the maid, is back on the case.
All right. Death in a hotel. Murder in a hotel.
Yes. And that was what the other one was. And Molly is a really fun, neurodivergent character. The first one was a total page-turner, so I'm hoping to get to this as my treat when I'm done with this grant work that I'm doing. And then the other one is a really fun book, Chris, that we just got in Book Cougar's headquarters. I requested it. It's called Someplace Generous, an Inclusive Romance Anthology. And this is edited by Elena Ellis and Amber Flame. And I found out about this because Jessica Pride, who was our guest on episode 202, who edited Black Love Matters, Real Talk on Romance, Being Seen, and Happily Ever Afters, is in this anthology, and it's her first time with a work of fiction being published.
Oh, that's exciting. Congratulations to her.
These are 22 never-before-published stories, and it's also the first book from this imprint. And this imprint was, I wanted to read this, actually, because I think it's really important. The imprint is called Generous Press, and on the inside of the flap, Generous Press publishes lush, high-caliber romance fiction by brilliant BIPOC, LGBTQIA+, and disabled authors. We tell finely crafted, poetic, cinematic, messy, weird, and swoon-worthy love stories, romance with a generous twist. A new radically inclusive imprint at Row House Publishing, Generous Press is built on joy and the conviction that all people should be cherished and free. And the two editors of this book are, I believe, the people who are running the press. And Elena Ellis was an editor for years at Copper Canyon Press. And then Amber Flame, it said something kind of funny. She has served as a copy editor, developmental editor, and general fluffer for all manner of texts.
That's great.
Yeah, so kind of two heavy hitters. The first book from this press, beautiful cover.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to digging in.
Oh my gosh, the cover, it has a black background. The print is a shiny gold. And then it has this beautiful hand holding very colorful flowers. It's delightful to look at.
It's really pretty. And they have, I think, by the time this episode drops, their first event on the book tour at Ripped Bodice in Brooklyn.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, Amber Flame. Mm-hmm. Is that her real name? Because that is a kick-ass name.
I believe so. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't know how not to know, but,
I know,
that's what's on there.
Amber Flame. I love that.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, you know, I don't know, Chris Flame. That just, you know, like, her parents had...
A good idea.
I was going to say good. It's not a sense of humor. Anyway.
Well, isn't Amber the name that your parents were thinking of giving you because of that book? Or am I?
Forever Amber. Yeah. Well, just the Amber and is a color and the flame. Amber. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Play on words.
Totally.
Totally. In the out now category, I believe these are from episode 200, where the authors recommended books to us. My Favorite Thing is Monsters, Book 2 by Emile Ferris. Service by Sarah Gill Martin. Anna Bright is Hiding Something by Susie Orman Schnell. All of those are available now.
And coming up next is our conversation with Sarah Paretsky. We are so honored that she was able to come on and talk with us. She's such a legend. We hope you enjoy our conversation with her.
Happy reading!
We are pinching ourselves because we can't believe that we are sitting here talking with New York Times bestselling author, mystery legend, and social justice advocate, Sarah Paretsky. Her 22nd V.I. Warshawski novel, Pay Dirt, was published last month. The first novel in the series, Indemnity Only, was published in 1982 and was a groundbreaking work in the mystery genre. In 1986, Sarah launched Sisters in Crime to help advocate for women mystery writers at a time when most women depicted in mystery novels were either victims or vamps. Prior to writing mysteries, Sarah volunteered as a community organizer in Chicago during the 1960s. She earned a PhD in history from the University of Chicago and an MBA from the Booth School of Business. It was during her subsequent successful decade working in marketing that Sarah started writing the V.I. Warshawski series. She has also published short stories, two standalone novels, and several nonfiction books, and continues to work for social justice through her Sarah and Two Sea Dogs Foundation. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's good to be with you.
Sarah, it's so nice to have you here. Chris has read a couple of the V.I. Warshawski novels. This is my first. I was so excited to read Pay Dirt. And we really do want to talk to you about Pay Dirt. There's so much to talk about this novel. But we thought it would be fun if you could take us back to when you were writing Indemnity in the 70s and 80s and how it came to be.
Okay. Well, it's not an exciting story, but I will try to make it brief instead of the long, unexpurgated version. I have been a lifelong reader of crime fiction, really, since I was in my teens. And I grew up in eastern Kansas. Rex Stout, who was famous for his Nero Wolfe series, had lived in the same county that I grew up in. And so his were probably the first mysteries that I read. But as I grew into a young adult and second wave feminism also swept me up at the same time, I began to see that the way that women were depicted in crime fiction was just a continuation of the way that women were seen in society, that if you were sexually active, you were just by definition wicked. And many mysteries, including the most famous ones like the Maltese Falcon, feature women trying to use their bodies to get good boys to do bad things, kind of like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. "The woman that thou gavest me made me do it," Eve whines to God. Anyway, women also could be sexually chaste, in which case they were unable to tie their shoes in public without adult supervision. And women also, their biggest role was to be victims, and often, as is still true today, victims of kind of horrific sexual violations. So it came into my head that I wanted to create a character who would turn the tables on those ways that women were shown. But even though I had been writing from early childhood, very privately, short stories and poetry and stuff, I never had imagined writing outside the home, so to speak. And I didn't have confidence in my voice, and it took a very long time. I would write a couple of pages, and then it wasn't going anywhere. And I realized in hindsight that I was trying to create Philip Marlowe in drag and not trying to create a real character. And then there came a day in October where I was working for the CNA insurance companies, which overlook Grant Park. And it was a dreary, miserable day. And I worked for a dreary, miserable excuse of a human being. And suddenly, as he was speaking, Fred, as I call him, to avoid libel and slander litigation.
Your lawyer, thanks you.
My lips were saying, "Gosh, Fred, heck of an idea." And the balloon, thought balloon over my head was saying, "You unspeakable, unprintable excrescence of a human being." And in that moment, I am not joking, that was when VI came to me. I thought, she had not been brought up in Kansas to be a good girl who didn't make waves. She didn't worry about getting fired. She just said what was in the balloon and went on her way. So I went home and started writing about her. And it was not a smooth, easy journey from beginning to end. I created a crime in the insurance world, since that was what I knew and I worked in. But 9 months went by. I'd written 70 pages, and I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't do this. And then I had a stroke of great good fortune that Stuart Kaminsky, who at that time taught at Northwestern, actually taught a night school course called Writing Detective Fiction for Publication. And I signed up. He gave me great advice. He loved the character and helped me smooth out some of the problems that I was having. And I finished it, and he sent it to his agent. And after a year of being rejected by 42 publishers, we found one.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah.
I love that thought bubble. And just, you know, the voice, kind of the voice is what came to you first, which is really
interesting. Exactly. And I think that's such a good point, Emily, because that really is what, to me, that's my whole life is voice, who speaks, who's silenced, trying to make it possible for people who are silenced to speak. And
right. Mm-hmm. Through your own silence, which is so interesting. That was a moment where you were feeling that way.
Yeah, in your for own sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really fascinating, because I know there are these strong women characters really, he helped me in my own life, like what would VI do? And I think that's just such a gift for women readers, and obviously men too, who need to have some depictions of real women.
Well,
yeah,
I've been lucky to have male readers, including my husband, who related to the character. But you know, if I was doing what she was doing, speaking, leaping tall buildings at a single bound, you know, in pay dirt, she gets beaten up, as so often happens in her hardworking life. She takes a nap, and then she shimmies up the side of a building and breaks into it. I'm thinking, if I was that person, I wouldn't be writing. I'd be out there doing it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, she does get worked over in all of the novels, I think. You know, there's those moments where fights happen, tough things happen. And you mentioned earlier the abuse against women, And this is a question we were going to ask a little bit later, but I think now is a great time to ask it. And one of the things we're wondering about is, you know, you've been writing this series for quite a while and dealing with social injustice issues against women. How do you take care of your own self, your own mental health, as you are writing about such horrific things?
I think it has become harder, not easier, not just for me, but for women in general. When I started, we were really riding a wave of life opening up for women, for possibility in many different arenas. The year that I first published in 1982 was the first year that women could serve with the regular police force in Chicago and in many other cities around the nation. We had Sandra Day O'Connor being the first woman justice on the Supreme Court a year earlier. There were just many opportunities up and down the work ladder. And we felt that our voices were being taken seriously, or more seriously than they had in the past. And then the backlash really came like a tsunami and whacked us in the face. And we're struggling with that. And I've been active in reproductive rights since before I was a published writer. And today I was down at Chicago City Hall to be part of a group trying to keep one of our clinics from being under constant attack by Illinois is a so-called haven state, but there are plenty of people who would like to turn us into Alabama or Texas. So you're asking how I look after myself. Well, there's a good question. How do I look after myself? I try to step back from time to time, even though I feel guilty when I'm not being active. But I have a beautiful garden where I can sit, and even though it's in the middle of the city of Chicago, I have a wonderful, it's a backyard, it's an urban backyard, but it's been turned into a beautiful garden. I have a dog whose superpower is sleep. I wish that was my superpower.
Amen, me too. Yeah, that's lovely. And I give you kudos for sticking with it. You know, like I think that it's hard to continue to fight when you see things moving backwards. But of course, ever so more important to do it when it's going in that direction.
Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk more about pay dirt.
Okay.
We thought we would read just from the back of the book in your notes and thank yous. You talk about Chicago and Kansas, because only four of the VI novels take place in Kansas, and this is one of them. And so I'm just going to read a little piece,
okay,
if you don't mind.
Thanks.
And this is Sarah writing in the back in the notes and thanks section of the book. Chicago has been my home for more than 5 decades, but I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, and have a strong attachment to the land of my youth. The land and its history keep speaking to me, drawing me into stories both real and imagined. Pay Dirt is the fourth of my novels to be set there. And then later on, in a couple paragraphs later, you say, knowledge of injustices in my home state has come to me slowly. And that's where this book really takes off, is you're looking at something historically that's happened in Kansas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
My family moved to Kansas from upstate New York when I was 4, and we stayed for the first few days that we were in town. My dad was the second Jew hired in a tenure track position at the university, so it was like we were unique in the town, and we were always to be on our best behavior, because if we acted out in public, it did not look good for the Jews. But the first few nights that we stayed there, we stayed in a hotel called the Eldridge, and that was the historic headquarters of the anti-slavery movement. When I was 4, that didn't mean anything to me, but as I grew up, it began to feel like, yeah, from my very first days in this town, I was connected to abolition and all the good guys and doing the right stuff. We celebrated the centennial of the town and of the state while I was in middle school. And, you know, again, it was like, gosh, this was exciting. We did such a great job. And we girls put on crinolines and acted out. The anti-slavery women sewed bullets into their skirts to smuggle them past the slavery forces that controlled access to the state. So then as I got into high school, I realized the town was segregated and my parents were actively involved in fighting that. And then I moved to Chicago and didn't really think more about it until I started learning through really the Black Lives Matter movement, so very late in time, that Kansas was a free state, but that didn't mean they were an abolitionist state. It just meant they didn't want slavery in the state. So that was kind of like, how did I get to be as old as I was before that hit me between the eyes? But the worst thing that happened, I mean, the most terrible thing that I learned, not the worst thing that happened to me, but the most shocking thing that I learned was from reading a book. I referenced it there, and I think it's called This Is Not Dixie. So he went into newspapers, and in, you know, back in the historic past, every little town or county had a newspaper, and there were a lot of Black newspapers and white newspapers that were telling different sides of the same story in the same towns and counties. And he found that between the end of the Civil War and 1935, and I don't know why he stopped in 1935, he found that there was a lynching of an African-American someplace in the state at least once a week during that 70-year period. His point, in a way, was, you know, stop thinking that racism and segregation and lynch mobs and wrenching people's property away from them, stop thinking that that was a Southern thing. It was a national thing. And the South was like a convenience that we could all pretend it only happened in one place, but it happened everywhere. It just made me feel that I needed to write about it. And I would say this is the hardest book I ever wrote. The issue is emotional and shocking and painful, but needed to be addressed. But really, what was really hard was to try to tell a story around it, as opposed to, and furthermore, you must never, you know, kind of being on either on a soapbox or writing what he had already done, which was a historical a look at that history. So I went back to the beginning on this book. I wrote this book from beginning to end. I mean, I have 9 drafts, and what you have in front of you is the 9th draft. But I would say of those 9 drafts, 5 of them were completely different versions from beginning to end. The other 4 were like, you know, I could use pieces here and there.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. I want to ask you, but I'm sure you don't want to talk about the details of those. But, I mean, it would just be so interesting to hear about. I guess you can't really talk about it because you'd be giving spoilers for this book.
Well, it's not just that, but I don't really remember now why I chose X instead of Y. I think what really made this version come to life for me was not the issue that I was writing about. It always has to be about people. It can't be about issues. For me to find it interesting to write about and for readers to find it interesting. And there's a character in the book named Trig. That's his nickname. Maybe because he's trigger happy. Nobody ever really knows why he's called Trig. He appeared in the first draft that I wrote, and he was just a kind of a stick figure. But as time passed and I kept going back and reworking it, I suddenly started remembering when I was an undergraduate at the University of Kansas, there were people who just could not leave the town and could not leave the campus. And if you've ever lived in a college town or a college neighborhood, you've probably seen this. They never graduated, or they never were able to move on to a job. And Trig is one of those people. And he just started taking on, and they often, as he did, would wear, which always seemed funny to me since I was at school during the Vietnam War and the Vietnam War protests. And some of the protesters who were consistently at every protest would wear these army fatigues, even though they had never served. And, you know, the big hair and everything. And so he just started inhabiting that world of people who just are misfits their whole life and then can't leave the school. And so he helped make the book come to life.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, another thing in the book is the issue of critical race theory.
Yeah.
I don't know if we want to jump into that right away, but, you know, you mentioned while you were just talking about history and digging up history and learning about things that were deflected into other areas of the country. And critical race theory plays a part in this novel. So we were hoping you could talk a little bit about why it's threatening for some people in ways that are maybe not immediately obvious.
I think writing this book, I mean, I say this kind of ironically or jokingly, but it isn't a joke, but, you know, I get it. I get you don't want to know mean, ugly, nasty stuff that took place that, you know, it would be much, life would be so much easier to have this anodyne version of reality. I have a PhD in history, but I'm not active. I don't stay in touch with what's happening in scholarship, so I can't really tell what is critical race theory, and really the people who are so agitated about it, I don't think they have a clue about what it is either. But the role it plays in the book is just because people are agitated about it without knowing what it is. So I have a young woman, she appeared in a previous novel in Fallout, and she is a social studies teacher, and I created an imaginary, a fictitious community outside the town of Lawrence in the county, but Lawrence does a lot of things really well, and I didn't want to be picking on the stuff that they do really well. So I have this separate school district. And Katie, her name is Katie Perrick. She's a social studies teacher there. And she puts together a class, which is what I would have done if I'd ever been teaching middle school or high school history, is, you know, you start with your own family and your own history. How did you end up in this place? And where did you come from? And what's your history? And I think once people think about their own lives, then they can start attaching it to bigger historic events, and the historic events then just aren't out there as something that has nothing to do with you. And so you don't care to learn about them. Anyway, so she's doing a section on Kansas history and where your life intersects with Kansas history. And suddenly there are protests, as there are in so many places, like, you're not teaching our children to respect the white settlers who really made this county and this state what it is. I was just on Sunday, I was taking part in a conference on censorship being run by the American Library Association. And all these librarians in Illinois, which is supposedly not Texas, they go to the grocery store and women start pointing at them and yelling, pedophile, pedophile, at them in public because they're supporting having LGBTQ books on their library shelves. It's like, these are just harsh, unbearable times. And that's what happens to Katie in the novel. She's not even interested in rocking the boat particularly.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the scenes I really appreciated was early on in the book when VI is in Kansas to see this woman's basketball game, the college basketball game, because one of the star players is going to be setting a record. And so her goddaughter asks her to come. And so they're all outside after the game. The players are signing autographs for some of the younger girls who are there. And, you know, these are their heroes and they're having a good time. And then all of a sudden, a father rushes up and is angry and grabs his daughter and says, you're not going with her. And like, it's just deflated. Like, the girl's enthusiasm and good time is just completely deflated. And I thought, I've been in situations like that, you know, where you see a parent acting out and not realizing the harm that they're doing, not only to their own child, but to other people's children. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was really well done.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, one of the things that I've started wrestling with more in the last maybe five novels, we're so lighthearted about violence, we crime writers. You know, people get beaten up or shot or killed or whatever, and then they just bounce back. You know, the archetype was Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler's famous detective. He gets concussed and comes to in his car. He always has a pint of rye in the glove compartment. Well, you shouldn't be drinking a pint of rye when you're concussed, or really any time you're behind the wheel of a car, but, you know, that was then, this is now. But it's similarly, you know, like, you've been assaulted in a horrific way, and then you just bounce back in the next chapter, you're doing what you're doing, and I can't take it anymore. And I'm actually taking a break from VI because struggling with all these issues in pay dirt, it did me in, and I don't have the wherewithal emotionally right now to go back and think about how to continue to do this. But lately, she does not use a gun. And that has been true for about 6 years now. No one has ever commented on this. I don't think readers have noticed this. But I took a pledge. There's an LA writer named Eric Beatner, and he kind of put it out there for some of us noir writers to see if we could write without using a gun. And it is surprisingly easy. You know, she still has her gun. She goes target practicing. She keeps it in shape, but she does not carry it or use it. The violence, and I start the book with this, and I realize I've confused readers because they think they're missing a book where the action in the first chapter sets the scene for why VI is just exhausted and needs a break. But she witnesses a violent death. They are seconds too late to stop a violent death. And it does her in. She stops working. She stops eating. And, you know, VI is a hearty eater. There are many women detectives in contemporary fiction who are anorectic, essentially. I mean, like Elizabeth Salander, who's so widely admired and adulated in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. She's not even 5 feet tall. She weighs 88 pounds. She has no body. She has no shape. I mean, she's a boy, not a girl physically. And when you look at her, VI has a body, but she stops eating. She can't deal with it. She stops everything, stops working. And the trip to Kansas is meant to kind of help her transition back into getting more involved in life. And I just think, I don't know what else to do, because the level of violence that we're experiencing as a country and really in the world, you can't make a game out of it anymore. And in a way, murder mysteries are game books. And I love them. I enjoy reading them. They're still my favorite reading. But as soon as I come on a graphic description of sexual mutilation violation, I am done with that writer, you know.
Yeah, I've had that experience too recently with some, you know, highly acclaimed books, and I just can't go past certain scenes anymore. The violence against women is just too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to make light of this at all, but we choose a read-along theme every year, and we do quarterly read-alongs with our listeners. And this year, we chose romance, which has been a surprise to us, and I think a surprise to our listeners.
So what was your favorite romance that you read in your read-along?
Oh, gosh. Well, we're only on our second one. The first one we read was by Beverly Jenkins, called Indigo, which is a historical romance. And next we're reading one by Nora Roberts. Neither of us have ever read anything by Nora, so we'll check in with you about that.
We're not experts, but part of what's interesting about, I mean, it is a very important genre to the industry and keeping the lights on in the publishing industry, but it's also, you know, you're guaranteed a happily ever after.
Yes.
And so it's a little bit about joy and pleasure and removing some of that, you know, I call them butt clencher novels of like worrying about what's going to happen. So, you know, maybe that's in your future. I don't know. I think that as the outside world has become, the violence has increased and there's so much tension in the world and our politics is very tense. It's hard. So I could see where you'd be looking at your work life differently.
Yeah. May we be nosy and ask what you're working on next, or are you still kind of looking?
Oh no, I am working. I'm not working very skillfully yet, and I realize that this is just how I work. I write and throw out and write and throw out. But I'm working on a book about, I have a woman named Lily. I don't have a last name for her. She may never have a last name. She was a CIA agent, and she served in a country called Hayalistan, which is Turkish for imaginary country. And she's retired now. She was forced into retirement. She's about my age. And for complicated reasons that I'm not going to take time to go into, because also those reasons will change as I write and rewrite. But she realizes that the CIA did something very naughty in Hayalistan. And she starts doing podcasts about it, and the CIA decides that they have to kill her. So the book is how Lily survives being targeted by the CIA. I'd written 150 pages, and then I realized that what I had was a sort of a travelogue about Hayalistan. I had so much fun with it that I realized that didn't notice I wasn't actually telling a story. I was just explaining. You know, Hayalistan has all these clans. It's an Islamic country, but the clans still are important. And Lily had an affair with one of the snow leopards, and
See, there's your romance.
Yeah. So, how do you write? Do you use pen, paper, or are you a computer
user? I'm straight into the machine. Okay. I do a lot of note when I'm working on trying to figure out what's going on or what's wrong or who the characters are. That I do all by hand.
Everyone has their own fetish. I like these Strathmore. Big Strathmore
look at that.
Things, and then I'm just writing, and then I tape the pages together. And
oh, very cool. Wow. It's like a big storyboard.
Yeah, sort of. I guess it's sort of a storyboard. I work slowly. I write fast when I know what I'm writing, but basically I work slowly. So then I read what I've written and put the action in columns so I can remind myself what was going on.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, cool. All right, this is a completely unfair question to ask you, and you may not want to answer it, but do you have a favorite Chicago bookstore?
Do I have a favorite Chicago bookstore? I am very lucky to live a 10-minute walk from the Seminary Co-op, which is, it's not a seminary bookstore. It was just, I didn't belong to it. I didn't go into it for my first 2 decades living in Hyde Park because I thought it was a religious bookstore. They called it that because it was in the basement of a theological seminary. That was where they rented space. But it's one of the big indies with 100,000 plus titles. And then I live on the South Side, Women and Children First. The original owners, I'm still very close to them, and it's still a wonderful bookstore. But because, you know, it's 15 miles, but you know what it's like. 15 miles in Chicago is an hour.
Yes.
15 miles in Kansas is 10 minutes.
Right.
So
I don't go there as often as I should to support them, but they have a pretty substantial support base.
They do. Yeah, so their first location, I remember going to their first location.
On Armitage or Halsted?
Yeah, I don't remember. I was going to ask you.
Little
where it was.
Hole in the wall.
Yeah, with creaky wooden floors and everything. Yeah.
And then that area became really trendy. They couldn't afford the rent, and they were really smart where they moved to, because it became both a yuppie neighborhood and with a significant gay and lesbian population too, and it's really thrived there.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you for answering that question.
Although there are a ton of good small stores here, and I don't mean to slight any of them, but
just curious about, you know, which ones are close to you. And I know I've been gone for 10 years and there are new ones cropping up.
You know, isn't that wonderful that despite Amazon and all that, more indies open every year? It's like, the book is not going anywhere.
No.
Stepped onto my shelves.
Yeah, right, look at that. Beautiful shelves. Yeah. Are a lot of those books behind you mysteries? Or
no, this is mostly my fiction. My office is on the third floor of my house, and I keep all the fiction on the second floor because that's what I would spend time going through and reading. And this is just reference books and my Black Studies section and my Jewish Studies section and stuff like that that isn't going to tempt me except when I need references.
That's a good plan. Nice.
Could we ask you one final question about Sisters in Crime?
Sure. You can ask me anything.
Okay.
And remember, I'm a fiction writer, so I might make it up.
Oh, the truth comes out. Never believe these interviews you listen to.
Yeah.
Well, you're a founder of Sisters in Crime.
I am.
So can you just tell us a little bit about why you started it and maybe what your role is there now?
My role there now is on the sidelines applauding a very activist and amazing group of younger women who are running it now, and I think are doing a fabulous job. When I started it in 1986, March of 86, Hunter College put on the very first conference on women in the mystery. As far as I know, nobody had ever gathered us together. I was a very new writer then. I'd published 2 novels. I was working on my third. And March of 86, I was on a panel talking about, I have no impulse control. It's my biggest handicap in life. But I was on an awards panel for Private Eye novels. And I talked about a particular book that was really, the whole storyline was about rape and
And I said, I didn't know what to do with the book because I couldn't burn it. That's against my religion. I didn't want to give it to a used bookstore because I really didn't want anyone else reading it. And I didn't want it on my shelf. So I was like, it was just this conundrum. And now I don't know what I did do with it in the end, actually, because I no longer have it. But the word got out in a very garbled way that I advocated banning books and burning books. And so I started getting calls from people. We're talking decades before the internet and email and so on. So I started getting calls and some snail mail saying, did you really say you were going to burn a book and ban a book? And then these conversations then would segue into what the experience was of women who were writing crime fiction. And I'm sorry, this is a very long answer to the question, but it's not a simple question with a simple answer. Sue Grafton, who wrote the Alphabet series and who sadly died young-ish, she and I published our first novels in 1982. And we both got, we met many years later. We didn't know each other. She was in Santa Barbara. I was in Chicago. But we both got great reviews, not very good sales, but a lot of recognition. And it wasn't until I started having these phone conversations, which started with, you know, what had I said, what had I done, but moved into me asking people about their experience, that I learned that my experience and Sue's experience was very unusual. Women were not, their books were not getting reviewed. And if your book is not getting reviewed, it's not just that no one knows to buy it, but libraries, which in those days were the lifeblood of fiction, well, of the whole industry, they accounted for close to half of all book sales. You had to be in two nationally juried publications for most libraries to want to put your book on their shelves. So women were staying in print for one book, and they were one and done. And there were other things. I mean, there were just microaggressions all the time about what you were doing. You know, this was a hobby for a woman, not a job. And just it was just constant. It was really ugly and unpleasant. So Flo Kennedy, great civil rights lawyer, she used to say, don't agonize, organize. And the biggest conference in the mystery world, named for the New York Times critic Anthony Boucher, the Boucher Con, is held in the fall of every year. And that year, I organized a breakfast for every woman writer I knew. In those days, I didn't know a lot, but there were not quite 30 people who RSVP'd. And I held a breakfast at the Boucher Con to see if people wanted to organize, because I thought we either do something about this or we shut up. And the energy was really powerful. And that was the origin of Sisters. And so all these, the 30 women who came to that breakfast, when I got back to Chicago, they started sending me more names and I started writing and, you know, explaining what we were trying to do. And then we did a questionnaire on what people's top priorities were. And really, reviews were the number one priority. So the first project we did, there used to be a publication called the Drood Review, which just covered every crime novel, thriller, et cetera, published in a given year. Jim Huang, the editor, kindly gave us a list of everything published in 1987. And then we just did grubby work. We went through 200 plus publications that included book reviews, and we tallied against the books that had been published in that year. And we found that a book by a man was seven times more likely to get reviewed in a national publication than a book by a woman. And so that was our first activist mission, was to start addressing that imbalance and that injustice. And then the organization grew from there.
Oh, gosh, well, thank you so much for the creation of that. I mean, you've changed the face of literature, of, you know, fiction for women everywhere, I think. Thanks. Bringing that to light and advocating for women writers and giving women writers such a sense of hope that it's possible for them to write and get published. Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I sit here, I'll be 77 in 2 weeks, and I think, what am I really done with my life? And did I really do that? But I really did do that.
Yes.
Yeah. And we appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I hope I'm not sounding boastful, but.
No.
Oh, gosh, not at all. Not at all. No, that's why I wanted to make it clear, like, the impact that organization has had for women writers and women readers who want to see themselves depicted in books more honestly than those, you know, old-fashioned noirs written by the guys.
As soon as we started going to both to publications, libraries, bookstores, we really did have a pretty quick impact. Like a lot of publications they weren't deliberately discriminating. They just were writing about what they looked like, you know, who they looked like. And then bookstores, it was so fun. There were two women or three, Sharon McCrum, Linda Grant, Carolyn Hart, I can't remember, I may be leaving someone out, who put together a books in print for us of all of the books that our members wrote, and they would take those to bookstores. And so bookstores might, you know, they might take one shelf of books by women writers, and then women started buying mysteries. We heard over and over again, I hadn't read a mystery since I outgrew Nancy Drew. And so then there would be a shelf, and then there would be a whole wall. And then pretty soon we were just writers. We weren't just segregated into this. So it happened pretty fast, and it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember those books of checklists of, you know, women mystery writers, and you have the woman, you know, her name, and then all of the books, usually in chronological order, so you could check them off. And I think it just became, there are too many women and so many books, and it became impossible to print books like that anymore. And I know you can find things like that online now.
Yeah.
So, well, this has been wonderful to talk with you. Yeah.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening to The Book Cougars with Chris Wallach and Emily Fine. We'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, come chat with us on social media, Goodreads, or email us at bookcougars@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast, please tell others about us, leave a review wherever you listen, and consider becoming a patron. Even $1 a month is a big help. Learn more about that on our website, bookcougars.com, where you'll find the show notes for this and all of our past episodes.
Thanks, everybody.
This episode was edited by Pat Keough Sound Design.